Chapter 16. Actor Without a Role. It is not that you must be free from fear. The moment you try to free yourself from fear, you create a resistance against fear. Resistance in any form doesn't end fear. What is needed, rather than running away or controlling or suppressing or any other resistance, is understanding fear. That means watch it, learn about it, come directly into contact with it. J. Krishnamurti. A week or two later, I'm on the mend and off the meds. I'm back to my routine of dog walking and strolling through town and visiting Frank in the evening for a nightcap. I spend most of my time at my work table, and Lisa spends several hours a day helping me and has replaced one of the local retirees who had been assisting me but who was made uncomfortable by the material and stopped coming. "Can I ask you about Brett?" Lisa asks. "What would you like to know?" "I don't know. Where'd she live? Where was the farm?" "Virginia, in the Shenandoah Valley. I liked going down there because it's beautiful driving, especially at night. Put on some good music, take your time, see where you are, like a magic carpet ride. Very pleasant." "What did she look like?"
"Redhead. Shoulder-length hair, always tied back. Sturdy, strong, not heavy, naturally pretty. She usually wore jeans, a denim shirt not tucked in, and cowboy boots." I look at Lisa over the tops of my reading glasses.
"Why?" "Just wondering. How old was she?"
"Like you. Maybe a few years older. 40? She's silent for a few minutes. I go back to my work.
"And she had a horse farm?"
Lisa asks.
"Brett?"
"Yes."
"I suppose that's what it was. She had horses and dogs and cats. Lots of land. A lake. A barn. A big indoor riding arena."
"Did she have people living there? Like students on the premises?"
No. She kept all that confined to these monthly Sunday meetings. Doubled up with a Saturday meeting a few times when I was there. But that was an exception. Other than when the people were there, the students, I don't think she had a thought for anything spiritual. It wasn't part of her life. She wasn't writing a book, didn't give talks or interviews, didn't travel. She just had the group that came on those Sundays. Dr. Kim seemed to be the one who made everything happen, not Brett. I think she just put up with it."
"Family?"
"A daughter and a granddaughter that I know of. Our biographies were never really exchanged." After another long pause, she asks another question.
"Did she seem happy?"
It occurs to me that Lisa might be looking at Brett as a role model, like someone she can look up to from her new and shifting vantage. She wonders if she can look to Brett to get an idea of where she herself is heading, or should be heading. I have no confidence in my ability to judge what's going on inside people, but it seems both clear and understandable that Lisa would want to spot a familiar face on the distant shore, and that she might be forming an image of Brett in her mind to fill that need. Whether that's good or bad, I don't know. But I do know that Lisa is not in the process of becoming what Brett became. Brett was awake from the dream state, which means she had moved from self to no self. Like dying without dropping the body. Lisa is awakening into human adulthood, which is the move from segregated to integrated self. It's huge, but it's about transition
within the dream state, not transitioning out of it. Brett made the same transition to adulthood, but, as with me, it was just the first leg of a longer journey. In her proofreading of book notes, Lisa has developed an affinity for anything related to Brett. So I print off a few pages she hasn't seen and pass them over to her, hoping that she'll understand the subject matter and see how it applies to her panicky desire to grab onto someone or something. "Is this like satsang?" asks one girl, a newcomer. "I ain't exactly sure what a satsang is," replies Brett, and a general discussion opens up with most everyone relating their satsang experiences. There are upward of 40 people in the bleachers tonight, all of whom seem to have an opinion to express or an experience to share on the subject of satsang. Brett lets them go on for several minutes about tranquility, deep awareness, shared silence, shakti, and how evolved and elevated and enlightened various teachers were or weren't before she steps back in. "Okay, okay. Everyone settle down now. I think I got the idea. And to answer the original question, no, this ain't that. Makes me sad to hear y'all talk like that about profound experiences and highly evolved teachers and whatnot. Seems like we can't make half an inch of progress around here. Let me say it again. I got no feeling for all this silence, peace, and tranquility business, and ain't nobody is special. Just like Mr. McKenna told you, we're all here together in a leaky boat on a shoreless sea. Ain't no better or worse among us. No one's higher or lower, ahead or behind. We're all in the same damn boat with the same damn view. The storm is raging and the clock is ticking. We don't know where we are or who, what, why, when, or how, for that matter. And anyone says otherwise is talking out their ass. This boat is full of ass talkers. They like to make it seem like we're all in this boat together. But the fact you got to learn is that we are each of us alone. Black sky and black water all around. And the closest thing to solid land is this little ship, which, by the way, is leaking like a rusty bucket. It might go down in 50 years or 5 minutes. No way of knowing when. But it will go down. And that's a fact. That shuts them up. "This sure isn't like any satsang I've ever been to," whispers a gaunt man up front, and there's some restrained laughter. Brett laughs, too. "Y'all are in this trance," continues Brett, "and you come here asking me to help snap you out of it. I can't help you, though. You got to get to where you want it enough to do it yourselves. And that ain't easy, because you got yourselves lulled into this damn complacency which sucks all the urgency out of your plight. It's like a coping mechanism. Y'all know what a coping mechanism is? It's like a tranquilizer. We keep ourselves strung out on tranquilizers all the time. But if you come here, you're saying you want to kick that habit. We're all in the hands of a loving God. That's one kind of tranquilizer we like to swallow. Means you can just sit back and pass the time. Be nice and say you're sorry when you done wrong, and your loving God won't cook your ass. Reincarnation is another pill that goes down easy. We're coming back again and again, so we got all the time in the world. We're subject to a bunch of karma, dharma, dipsy doodle, and we just gotta be good little sheep. No pressure, no urgency, nothing to do but lay low and ride it out. Or maybe we're all divine beings of light, and all we gotta do is sparkle and shine and live a pretty life. Play nice and not kick up a fuss. She kicks up a spray of sand. Y'all starting to see a theme emerging here? Be nice. Be quiet. Be good. Don't ask questions. Don't use your minds. Don't make a ruckus. Sound familiar? That's what all this satsang talk sounds like to me. Like you start feeling a little agitated, so you need a fix. Got to get some more tranquility. Like that's the purpose of these teachers and gurus you keep talking about. They keep you mellow, keep you doped up so you don't gotta face your situation. Sounds like the exact opposite of waking up to me. Some heads nod. Some shake. No one speaks. Most of them know what happens if they try to assert their beliefs as facts, or mistake the popularity of a belief for the probability of it being true. Brett lights into that kind of flabby talk like a mad mama bear. Now she takes it up a notch. But here we are on this storm-tossed ship, and if someone starts telling me everything's all glorious and divine, so I should just sit down and shut up, be cool, be mellow, close my eyes and clear my mind, I'm gonna kick up some fuss. I'm gonna ask that person to make some serious sense. And I'm gonna want to see some evidence. I ain't got no time for ass talkers with all their dainty ideas about heavenly booty. I don't want to hear a lot of fancy sermons and poems and clever guesswork. I want some facts. Anyone saying they know something is saying they got the most precious commodity to be found on such a ship. They got some knowledge. And if they say they got it, I'm going to want to see it. And if they can't produce it, I'm going to take that hard, and I'm going to want to chuck them out of my damn boat, maybe do some keel hauling. Y'all know what keel hauling is? It means death to the ass talkers. They ever tell you that in your little sing-sang circle jerks? Nervous laughter ripples through the bleachers. But they ain't got no knowledge, she continues. That's what I learned in my life. That's what I know, that y'all don't. There ain't no knowledge to be had. All they got is tranquilizers, which is all most folks want anyway. This little ship we're talking about is full of every kind of crafty drug pusher, selling every kind of painkiller you can imagine. And business is always good, because we're all a bunch of strung-out junkies looking for our next fix. Y'all hear me in the back row? We gotta stay doped up. We're all just looking for a pill we can swallow. Something that'll take the edge off, dull the senses, and make everything look all soft and rosy all the time. Once you're hooked, it's damn tough to kick. Self-deceit is the hardest habit to break, 'cause it tells us we ain't self-deceived. She pauses and drinks. So, how do we break this habit? Asks the girl who started this with her satsang question. Easy, Brett answers. You just got to do two things. First, you got to know you're hooked. I don't mean know it like you know it now, like an idea you heard someone say. I mean you got to know it complete, like in every fiber of your being. Like every thought is darkened by it. Like every sight and taste and smell is poisoned by it. You gotta know it like a fiery pain. Y'all know what pain is? No one is laughing now. Then, once you get to that point, she says, and she uses the heel of her boot to draw a deep line in the sand between herself and the bleachers. The next thing you do is draw a line, just like Mr. McKenna keeps telling you. That's how it's gotta happen. You draw a line. You make a stand. You say, that's it. I've had enough. This is as far as I go till this shit starts making some sense. And you mean it with your whole life and being. You put it all on that line. Until you do that, you ain't done nothing. You're just going along to get along. Lisa sets down the pages and rubs her temples and sits quietly for a few minutes before speaking. Is that right, about crossing the line? I don't answer her question immediately. People around me get used to my silences. The answer will be along shortly, and I may or may not share it. It's not the correct answer that eludes me, but the handling of it. Though it's not up to me to act as arbiter of what's good and bad for others, I patiently observe. I act when I see what to do, and I don't when I don't. The situation here is that Brett was a zero-tolerance, anti-bullshit hardliner, and Lisa is transitioning into human adulthood. The misconception lies with Lisa, who has started to identify with Brett, to look at her as a beacon of light in the darkness. Understandable, but probably not wise. After a few minutes during which my mind wanders completely away from Lisa's question, I look over to see her patiently watching me, and I remember her question about crossing Brett's line in the sand. I don't struggle to concoct a reply. Often, the right answer is full disclosure. Just lay it all out where it can be seen and let people do what they want with it. Lisa is drowning. She's trying to grab onto something, and she sees Brett. Who am I to withhold? Let her have whatever she wants. That's the answer. Usually, when we think of someone drawing a line, making their stand, we think they're committing themselves to an all-or-nothing battle, here and now, on this spot, live or die. That's the kind of ultimatum Brett was describing. She made it sound like a fight, like put up your dukes. But it's really not. It's the end of fighting. The end of a lifelong struggle. Drawing this line doesn't mean battle stations, red alert, DEFCON 1, and all that. It's not that kind of battle. It means we have to lower our shields, not raise them. An objective observer might look at the vast majority of spiritual seekers today and classify them as spiritually self-lobotomized. They set out to find life and discover truth, and wind up sitting in a dark room, repeating a meaningless syllable, eyes closed, brain silenced, convinced that they're actually making a great journey. That's how easily and effectively we are undone. And it's because the enemy is within, running the show, redeploying all of our mental and emotional resources against us. Instead of adopting a warlike posture, we must, counterintuitively, lower our shields and defenses. This seems confusing until we understand that we are both the protagonist and the antagonist in this conflict, both attacker and defender. This is the paradoxical nature of the struggle. We can't win by fighting. The very thing that fights, that resists, is the thing we seek to overthrow. Only by vanquishing ego can we prevail. Only in surrender can we find victory. This is the part so few get, and fewer get beyond. This is the part where everything starts sounding all sagely or zenny or Orwellian, but that can't be helped. If you want to say that all religions and spiritual teachings share a core truth, it can only be this. Surrender is victory. And that's what I tell Lisa. She's quiet for a long moment. "Does this apply to me?" she asks. "You spent 3 painful years fighting against the process. Only when you stopped fighting did you start winning. You may not see it clearly yet. I'm starting to. I really am. This is all so new. What you've gone through was a big deal, like a dam bursting. Such an event requires a long, slow buildup as a hardened and reinforced structure slowly succumbs to forces that must eventually prevail. The release, when it finally comes, is going to be violent and tumultuous and destructive. But the dam created an unnatural imbalance, and it had to give way sooner or later. After the dam bursts, the built-up pressures are expended. The waters settle. Equilibrium is restored, and everything returns to its natural, harmonious, balanced state. Maybe you feel bad about the villages and crops that got decimated, or the man-made lake that got drained. But whatever relied on the imbalance provided by this unnatural obstruction was always in peril, doomed from the start. Then why don't we see it happening more often? These dams are very strong and generally outlive their builders. Most people manage to keep energetically reinforcing this artificial obstruction their entire lives and to die before it gives way. You didn't. So I drew this line? I did that? Of course. At the level of awakening within the dream state, you've been through this process. You thought of it as a psychotic break when your son said he wanted to be like your husband, and you snapped and grabbed Maggie and left. That was the long-awaited dam burst, the end of one thing and the beginning of another. It seems like a total mental breakdown. It's hard to think of that as some sort of spiritual victory. It's not some sort. It's the only sort. Hard to believe. That's because the waters haven't settled yet. You're still seeing the cataclysm, the fallout, the collateral damage. When everything settles, when you settle, you'll see this new landscape and reckon it an earthly paradise compared to what it was. It all seems so cruel. I know it looks that way, but when you look at the larger forces at work, what seems cruel is revealed as the natural order of things, as balance being restored. People want desperately not to go through what you've gone through. Everyone wants to maintain their state of radical imbalance, all their energy and life force held to one side of this artificial barrier, rather than undergo this personal apocalypse. Most people manage to hold the waters back their entire lives, but you didn't. So now you get a different kind of life. Lucky me, she mumbles. Lucky you, I agree. Brett was fond of pointing out that there are no levels of advancement in this regard. Death and rebirth is a very specific event, not one that is gradual over many years. She said that there are no beginner, intermediate, or advanced levels, and she was right. It all comes back to surrender, which flows naturally from seeing what is, rather than faith or belief, which are how we muddle along when we don't see. That's a message that bears a lot of repeating, or so it seemed to Brett, and to me. You get a lot of people approaching spirituality like they know something, like they're pretty far along, and they don't realize that there is no such thing as pretty far along. You've either crossed the line, or you haven't. You're either in the process, or you're not. Knowledge, understanding, scholarship, experience, None of it means anything.
She sounds like a very strong woman.
Brett?
Yes?
I consider.
No?
She asks. It misses the mark, I say. The world is full of strong women. You're a strong woman. Your mother was a strong woman. If you call someone like Brett strong or weak, start applying attributes, you've already missed the one thing worth knowing about her. When you get past the surface of Brett to the part that was worth knowing about, there's nothing there. That's what all this is about. The rest is costume.
And that's true of you, too?
It's true of everyone. Lisa has no precedent for what's happening to her. And more importantly, she has no precedent for becoming something for which she has no precedent. Never before, in all her many personal and professional accomplishments, has she been in a situation where she couldn't see what she was doing by looking at thousands or millions of others who had done it before her. I'm only figuring it out now as I watch her, but that's what I'm coming up with, and I'm reasonably sure I'm right. She's starting to sense the broader dimensions of her aloneness. Lisa has no idea where her life is going. It must be far more traumatic and unnerving than she's letting on, as if she woke up in the middle of the night and ran away from her tribe into self-exile. And now it's the next morning, and she's wandering around in the wilderness, lost, alone for the first time, with no way to know what direction is best or how fast to go. I'm only picking up on it now as she tries to build up an image of Brett, and I ask myself why she has this interest in a woman she never knew and never would. Lisa doesn't know who to be now that she can no longer be who she was. She's an actor without a character to play. She doesn't know how to dress, how to eat, how to act, what to say, what to do. She doesn't even know what her motivation is. Good for her.
Chapter 17. A Literate Ignoramus.
The books we need are the kind that act upon us like a misfortune, that make us suffer like the death of someone we love more than ourselves, that make us feel as though we were on the verge of suicide, or lost in a forest remote from all human habitation. A book should serve as an axe for the frozen sea within us. Franz Kafka.
I wish I could have met her, says Lisa, putting some Brett pages down, though I guess she wasn't the sympathetic type. She was very different when she wasn't in front of her group, I say. Less fiery, less accent, nicer. Definitely preferred animals to people. Whether she would have gone hard or easy on you, I don't know. Why would she have gone hard on me? For your own good. 'Twere best done quickly, like pulling a tooth. Brett might have felt the kindest thing would be to take a lash to you, keep you from dawdling and making things harder than they have to be. Am I dawdling? I seem to be lying around a lot. It feels like I should be doing something, doing more. There's a natural pacing to things. If you get too scared or too smart and start messing around, you'll probably just foul yourself up. You've released the tiller. Don't panic and try to grab it back. Take it easy on yourself. All is well. She sighs. I don't know what to do next. I feel like, I don't know, like I have to be doing something. Your old relationship to time has been destroyed. You should take some time
to think about that, to think about time, your time, how you spend your days and weeks and years, what they are to you, and what you want from them.
That's totally outside my way of thinking, she says. My whole life has been a madhouse of things needing to get done right away. I can't remember ever thinking any other way.
You're off the clock now.
The race is over. When the next thing needs doing, you'll know it. This stuff is governed by a perfect intelligence. No thinking or meddling or second-guessing required. Just relax into the process. Trust it. Don't struggle against it. That's what it's all about.
That's what you were saying to Maggie, wasn't it? About not choosing to wear a blindfold and walk with a stick.
Sounds like. And that's how you live your life?
Seems like.
She sits watching me. She hasn't fully closed her mouth.
But really, though, I mean, really?
Really. She's staring at me as if suspended somewhere above this conversation, unable to come down on either side. She thinks that life, as she has always known it, is normal and natural. It may be the former, but it's far from the latter. From my perspective, I feel comfortable saying that we human beings have no idea of what we truly are or of what we are truly capable. None whatsoever. She's still staring at me.
Say what you want, I tell her.
Her mouth is still open, and now her head has taken on a slight wobble.
It can't be, though, she manages, her mind in conflict with itself.
I give her a nudge.
You are some kind of control freak or something? I ask.
That's all it takes.
No, she says defensively. Not a control freak.
Exactly.
Maybe by your rather laid-back standards, but, I mean, we had a very complicated and demanding life. There wasn't a lot of room for, you know, carelessness. Everyone had to do their part, or the whole thing would... Meals, laundry, bills, shopping, school, work, social commitments, schedules, chores. My God! Errands, sports, getting everyone where they had to be on time. A million things. At home, at work, at school, everywhere, every day. No days off. It all has to get done, you know. And I'm the one who had to make sure it did.
Does that make me a control freak?
I had to be very organized, and I was. I had to keep everyone on task. You know, there's so much to do, and there's no room for screw-ups or everything else gets messed up. I don't think that's being a control freak. I was just running a normal, busy household.
So then, no, not a control freak. She takes a breath.
I don't think control freak is an appropriate designation. I did what I had to do, that's all. I was good at it. I was proud to do it well.
May I make an observation?
Yes, okay.
You might get offended.
I'll try not to.
Okay.
It's a very common thing, but of the utmost importance.
You don't know how to breathe.
Oh, she says, nodding vigorously. Yes, I know. My trainer told me the same thing. I'm trying to
stop, please.
It's not that you're not doing it right. It's that you don't know how to do it at all. Your body doesn't know how. I've been watching you. You yawn like it's illegal. You sneeze like a kitten. Your voice is nasal and puny. You're never really relaxed. Learning to breathe is a big deal. It might take you a year to break bad habits and learn good ones. It's critical to everything, and it's not easy. You really have to put your attention on it. Learn about it. Develop the muscles. Make it a habit. You have to retrain your mind and body. It's not a simple thing. "Oh, my God," she says in exaggerated despair. "As if I don't have enough to worry about. Now I don't know how to breathe." This comes before everything. If you don't breathe well, nothing else is going to work right. The mental, physical, and emotional stuff all relies on full, healthy breathing. Here, hold your hand out. I hold up mine next to hers. Mine is mannequin steady. Hers is wet kitten trembling. Do you have trouble falling asleep at night? Lay there, fretting about stuff you know shouldn't be bothering you so much? "No," she says. "Maybe." I wait. "Yes." That's because your body and mind are oxygen-deprived, and that puts you in a panicky state. Practice proper breathing when you go to bed, and you won't have that anymore. I don't want to lecture you, but nothing is going to work right if you don't breathe properly. You really should learn about this and why it's important and how to do it. Make it a top priority. This is the best advice I have to give. I sit back and take a slow, deep breath and release it. Breathing and wakefulness go together. It's cleansing, refreshing, centering, all that. For me, breathing consciously evokes the warm feeling of gratitude for what I have, mixed with the recognition that, with every breath I take, it's all passing away. This isn't mystical or enlightened. It's not a path or a destination. It's just basic awareness. I can see she's getting offended and trying to hold her tongue. Her musculature is tightening, and her breathing is becoming hitched. "Yes," she says tersely. "You talk about breathing in your books." "Try to observe your current state," I suggest. "This is the kind of thing I'm talking about. You have no shock absorption. Every little bump in the road feels like a boulder. Your hackles go up, and your fight-or-flight response gets triggered by things that should blow over you like a breeze. Do you ever take naps or baths?" "I'm not really the kind of person who can just..." "That's old thinking, and it needs to be reevaluated in light of your changed circumstances. You wanted to know what to do next? This is clearly it. You have to retrain your body and mind and emotions. You're becoming a new person, and things like breathing and naps and bubble baths and long walks and tickle fights with your daughter should no longer be viewed as non-productive activities. They are no longer non-essential. They are now of the essence. This isn't a tidy, compartmentalized little process you're going through. You are being completely reconceived, and you have to be receptive to the process in all things and at all levels. The degree to which you resist or ignore or neglect or otherwise thwart the process is the degree to which it will cause suffering. Still, I can tell by her body language and facial expressions that she's not receiving this well. "You're probably going to resist this breathing thing and blow it off in a day or two, so I'll do you a favor and force you into doing it." Her eyes widen at the challenge, but she doesn't say anything. Maggie doesn't know how to breathe either. Scared, mousy little upper chest breathing, just like you. You've gone to all this trouble to keep her from making the same mistakes you made. So here's a wonderful place to focus your efforts. You have to learn yourself, so you can teach her. So there you go. Now you'll be doing it for your daughter. An hour later, I'm napping on one of the recliners by the pool, and Lisa is doing some research on the laptop. Maggie has joined us, I learn, when I open my eyes and find her staring at me. Are you awake? She asks.
C'est mon métier, I witticize groggily.
I have a question, she says.
Okay.
You know how Jolene has her experience in church? In the first book, where she sees everyone as cows, and that changes her whole, like, outlook?
Yeah, I reply, and make a mental note to give the first two books a quick read-through before finalizing the third.
What was your thing like that?
I know she doesn't think of it this way, and her mom is only half-listening, but precocious little Maggie just asked me about my first time.
Well, I tell her, there was this guy named Mortimer. Sometime in my late teens, I picked up How to Read a Book by Mortimer J. Adler, and it was, quite unexpectedly, one of those wonderfully devastating books that tear down walls to reveal new and previously unsuspected vistas. I had read hundreds of books by that time, including a lot of the heavy stuff, not necessarily for classes, but just because I fancied myself a reader. I read a lot, and I enjoyed it enough to keep doing it. But then, here comes this book by Adler, and in the first 10 or 15 pages, I found out that I'd never really read anything. Bam! I didn't know how to read. It was an epiphany, a thunderbolt, a mini-enlightenment, my first big one since Santagate. Not only was I not appreciating literature anywhere close to the level it merited, but far worse, I was effectively inoculating myself against it. I was penetrating books only to the degree necessary to cross them off my must-read list. I returned to many of the books I had read and thought of as friends, only to confirm what Adler said. These books were almost complete strangers to me. I knew them as intimately as if I'd merely read brief synopses of them years ago. I was, as Adler put it, a literate ignoramus. I had read widely, but not well. Looking back on it now, I mark How to Read a Book as my first book, and have since gone back to reread many books correctly. I also realized that I was reading for a lot of wrong reasons and became much more selective and self-serving in my reading choices. I began owning the process instead of being owned by it, making determinations as to what was good or bad by my own lights instead of by the weight of common opinion. It was quite a bewildering experience to have the rug yanked out from under me like that. But it was also a thrilling discovery. That's the death-rebirth experience right there. Yes, a guy named Mortimer popped my epiphany cherry. After that, it was just a matter of scale. Rather than being hurt or angry to have my ego balloon popped, I was exhilarated to find out that what I thought was solid and real could be so easily reduced to vapor. He was calling me a blockhead, an ignoramus, and sophomoric, which some might find offensive, I suppose, but it was true. He was absolutely right. Mortimer Adler was the first guy to call me on my bullshit, and I'm still grateful to him for it. Sad to say, but yes, I enjoyed having my nose rubbed in my own shit, and yes, I think it's a prerequisite for any form of growth in life. Man is a self-fertilizing animal. We rise up out of our own shit, or not at all. Adler wasn't enlightened. He didn't have robes or carry flowers. But when it comes to real teachers, I think of thoughtful guys like Adler. Guys who smash people's glass houses, not the guys who help erect and preserve them. Jesus never did as much for me,
or any priest, or even any of the teachers I had known and trusted. What the hell was going on with them? Adler's book came out in the 1940s. Why wasn't his book handed to me on the first day of my education, before any other book? Why did they let me waste those thousands of hours misreading books, plowing through them like they were nothing more than notches on my library card? Were there other areas in my life where I was so misinformed and mistaken? Why were all my teachers and professors giving me good grades? What the hell was wrong with them? That's another wonderful lesson I took from Adler's book. Those who you're most likely to trust for what you need to know may not know it themselves. You're on your own. Think for yourself, or not at all. The Adler book taught me many lessons that would take root and develop and become the most important in my life. Because what I had learned about my own reading ability was as true or truer for virtually everyone else, it taught me that everyone could be confidently, convincingly, and completely wrong. Suddenly, I was looking at everyone in a much different and harsher light. Adler showed me that teachers and writers and experts could not only be wrong, but could be the very agents by which wrongness is perpetuated in the world. Unwitting double agents, you might say, but for whom? Slovenly and lemming-like habits of thought, I incorrectly assumed. This was a very important lesson in universal doubt and distrust, which I went on to further refine and appreciate, and which I now hold to be the fundamental guiding principle of an honest life. Guilty until proven innocent, false until proven true. Every belief is wrong until proven right. No man, teaching, religion, system of thought, doctrine, ideology, or creed is sacred unless it's indestructible. If something is worth understanding, it's worth self-verifying. If it's not worth self-verifying, it's trivia and may be safely disregarded. Impartial distrust, combined with an understanding of the word further, is all that is needed to awaken from the dream state. Honesty and perseverance must invariably lead to the truth-realized state. Where else? And how else to get there? Add spiritual autolysis and white-hot intent, and you'll be the one writing the books in a few years. The Adler experience taught me that wrong-knowing, rather than not knowing, may be the truer and far more insidious form of ignorance, that what we consider our strengths can be the devious hiding places of our most debilitating weaknesses. It taught me that what we do see is nothing, and what we don't see is everything. It taught me that where I thought things ended might be where they were just beginning. That there was a world beyond the world I saw, a me beyond the me I knew, and, likely as not, more beyond those. It taught me that finding out you're wrong was much better than finding out you're right, that disillusionment and disenchantment were the better part of the process of growing and learning. It taught me that the pain and embarrassment of discovering our own folly and falsity was the price of moving beyond it. No pain, no gain. And that the blows that my self-image had to endure were blows it should endure. And perhaps there was something of the flagellant in me and should be. It taught me the startling truth that a kid not yet in his 20s could see beyond what the experts saw, and could leave them all behind. That's big and important. All the recognized experts can be just as wrong as those who recognize them as such. And it's possible, even easy, to move beyond them all. Simply by taking one small step, I had effectively moved into a new and much less populated realm of understanding. If you understood what I said about Moby Dick in Incorrect, you see a perfect example of this exact thing. I wasn't the first guy to make sense of that book, because I could outthink all the great thinkers who'd read it and delivered their high-blown and nonsensical pronouncements upon it. It was simply that I was able to see it from the more elevated perspective at which it resolved into clarity and made perfect sense. It's not about knowledge or scholarship or intelligence. It's about clear seeing. Although I was surprised and disillusioned to discover that so much of the well-read world, educators and educated alike, functioned at such a shallow and easily transcended level, I overcame the temptation to place the blame for my ignorance anywhere but on myself. The shutters that had been closed against the light were mine to open or not. I was influenced, but not constrained. The chains that bind us in Plato's cave are strong, but they are not locked. If we don't set them aside and stand up and make a start, we have no one to blame but ourselves. It taught me that, having taken one step, there might be more steps to take, and having understood that the cause of my ignorance was within, I was open to the idea that there were more such blind spots within. I was no longer one of those die-cast people, just as Jolene was no longer one of those cows. Now I was something else, and I could continue to develop along those lines. It taught me that there were two kinds of understanding: understanding for success and understanding for life. Understanding for success meant following the herd. Understanding for life meant following reason and facts and your own head and heart, wherever they may lead. Understanding for life was an entirely different pursuit, and one I much preferred. It showed me that these two paths diverged, and that, as Frost said, taking the one less traveled could make all the difference. And I say now that it did. In short, Mortimer J. Adler introduced me to Maya. He showed me how to see her, and to see her is to destroy her. That sounds like a lot to learn from one simple insight, but that's the nature of insight and of the process of unbecoming. It's like the pin that pops a balloon, or the spark that triggers an explosion, or the breeze that topples a house of cards, or the crack that bursts the dam. That's the momentous difference a single click of our mental dials can make. When's the last time you completely revolutionized yourself? When's the last time you became fresh and wide-eyed and new? These books I write carry the same message as Adler's book, only on a different scale. We can't escape the fact that, in these books, I'm calling all believers delusional and all beliefs untrue. If I'm wrong in this, then I'm just another ass talker, as Brett would say. But if I'm right, then it's a pretty damning indictment of all belief systems and everyone who subscribes to them. Says Adler, "I have said some things about the school system which are libelous unless they are true. But if true, they constitute a grave indictment of the educators who have violated a public trust." he goes on to say of schools, what I say of all teachers and teachings. If the schools were doing their job, this book would not be necessary. And on experiencing great teachings at second or third hand, they may be all right if all you want is some kind of information, but not if it is enlightenment you seek. There is no royal road. The path of true learning is strewn with rocks, not roses. Anyone who insists upon taking the easier way ends up in a fool's paradise. A bookful blockhead, ignorantly read, a sophomore all his life. After that, it's just a matter of scale. Chapter 18. Spiritual Dissonance. If the eye never sleeps, all dreams will naturally cease. If the mind makes no discriminations, the 10,000 things are as they are, of single essence. To understand the mystery of this one essence is to be released from all entanglements. When all things are seen equally, the timeless self-essence is reached. No comparisons or analogies are possible in this causeless, relationless state. Sozin. How is it possible that so few are able to find the only thing that can never be lost? How can we actually accomplish the miraculous feat of seeing what's not and not seeing what is? By what specific mechanism does delusion maintain its hold over those who seek to free themselves of it? When it comes to determining what makes it into the books, one thing I consider is what I would have liked to read about back when I was trying to get all this stuff figured out for myself. One question that always weighed on me was, what's the big mystery? Why should it be so hard to find answers to such simple questions? What's true? What's going on here? What's the point? Who am I? People generally seem content to believe that the universe is a mystery and the meaning of life is unknowable and to leave it at that. But someone who wants answers to the larger questions cannot be so easily dissuaded. Obviously, it seems to be a mystery, but why? What is the nature of this mysteriousness? Is it the nature of the universe to be mysterious? Is it the nature of meaning to be unknowable? Are we drugged, or bound, or hexed? Is there some agent or agency in charge of keeping us in the dark? Who or what is withholding or hiding reality from us? Why should something so simple be so difficult? What I discovered was that our ignorance isn't compulsory. It's voluntary, even self-inflicted. Nothing is hidden or withheld. Truth is not inherently mysterious, and there is no conspiracy to keep us ignorant. There is, however, an actual process, a mechanism of delusion, which is at work inside each of us. The name I use for this mechanism of delusion, borrowed from Hinduism, is Maya. Maya, it should be remembered, is not an actual arch-deity thwarting us from on high. Maya is inside us, a part of us, and is in complete control of us. Maya is the fear that permeates us so fully that we don't know it's there. Maya is the organizing principle of emotional energy in the fear-based, segregated state. And Maya is inherently mysterious. It's late afternoon, and things are winding down on the pool deck. It's been a busy day, with more people coming and going than usual. But now it's down to Lisa and Maggie and me. I'm at my big table. Maggie is working on some project at the raised island in the kitchenette. And Lisa is by the pool, soaking in the mellowing rays. This estate we're on is not what I was looking for when I came to Mexico. I wanted something cozier, more like Frank's house, but not in town. This place is ridiculous in many respects. Too big, too fancy, too high-tech, too ostentatious, too expensive. But it's also perfect. I'm very happy in this pool house and often sleep here instead of in the casita. It's a lovely place to live and work, quiet and private with magnificent views, but I could have found those qualities elsewhere. What I like most about this place, and what I wouldn't have found in a house more like Frank's, is having Lisa and Maggie on the grounds. If they were staying in their own place, or with Frank, I would see very little of them. But here they are, and they both, in different ways and to different degrees, play important roles in the creation and content of this book. I don't have to chase them down or make phone calls and appointments to talk with them, which would be in violation of my agreement with the universe, and which is exactly the kind of thing I wouldn't do. They're right here, close, available, accessible. This is another good example of the book being laid out for me, and of my part in recognizing patterns and moving with them, like renting this totally inappropriate property when my rational mind had me looking for something very different, like inviting virtual strangers to come live here, like the unexpected windfall that arrived, perfectly timed to cover the higher rent, like everything that has brought me to this place and put me in touch with these people and others who are so integral to the process and content of the third book, and like much more that I have space to share here. Maggie finishes whatever she was doing and comes over to take a seat at my table. She sits quietly for a few minutes before asking what I'm working on. "Cognitive dissonance," I answer. "I don't know what that is," she says. "Neither do I," I say. "I'm trying to figure it out." "What is it?" I read from my notes. "Cognitive dissonance is a term used in psychology to describe the discomfort we feel when our thoughts and beliefs come into conflict with each other." She scowls at me. "Give a for instance," she says. "Okay. Say, for instance, that I'm opposed to the slaughter of innocent animals, but I also like to eat meat. See what I mean?" "So you're doing something that goes against what you believe." "Right. Which is okay as long as I'm not very aware of it, like if it stays in the shadowy outskirts of my awareness. If it doesn't bother me, it's not a problem. What's an itch if it doesn't itch?" "If it doesn't itch," she says logically, "then it's not an itch." "Then what is it?" "Nothing." "Right. But then, if it does itch," "right, if it does itch, then it becomes a problem, and I'll have to do something about it."
"Like scratch it?"
"That's one possibility. What's another?"
"You could ignore it."
"You could try. What else?"
"I don't know. Put something on it?"
"Right," I say. "Or maybe just remove the cause, as in pulling a splinter or flicking off a bug."
"Yeah," she says.
Other answers I would have accepted include painkillers, as in drugs or alcohol, amputation, as in cutting off the afflicted area, and suicide, as in jumping out a window. But those are a bit above Maggie's pay grade.
"So what do you do," she asks, "if you eat meat but don't want the animals hurt?"
That doesn't seem like the right question, I might have gone my whole life eating meat and not wanting to see animals hurt.
So that's not the problem, she works it. The problem is, I wait.
That it started to itch?
That sounds right, doesn't it? It's not a problem until it starts to itch. If circumstances force me to become acutely aware of this dissonance in my cognitions, my thoughts, then it will cause me discomfort, and that discomfort will require relief. The most obvious way for me to relieve my discomfort would be to stop eating meat. But beliefs are much easier to change than behavior, and I really don't want to stop eating meat. So I'd probably just change my views on the slaughter of innocent animals and keep eating them.
Like, how would you change your views?
Maybe by deciding that if they weren't raised for food, they would never have had a life at all. Then instead of being responsible for the killing of animals, I'd be responsible for giving them life. Problem solved.
But is that really true?
I don't think it has to be true, I reply. It just has to stop the itch. I don't want to be limited to a textbook definition of cognitive dissonance, so we'll rechristen it spiritual dissonance and define it afresh. Spiritual dissonance is what occurs where our inner world meets our outer world, where what we think is true butts up against what appears to be true, where internal belief collides with external reality. It's the discomfort that occurs where self and not self come into contact. Ego is like the thin sheath of atmosphere between the earth of self and the infinite space of not self, holding one in and the other out. We live out our lives in this narrow band, never digging too far down or testing our upper limits. This is where our emotional energy is spent, pumped into this gap between two incompatible surfaces, keeping them from grinding against each other and jolting us out of our slumber. That grinding, when it does occur, is spiritual dissonance. Spiritual dissonance is the mental-emotional counterpart of negative physical drives like hunger and pain. We experience physical discontent because we are hungry, so we eat. We experience physical pain because our finger is in a flame, so we pull it out. Similarly, when we experience the discomfort of spiritual dissonance, we seek relief, though it's not likely to be as simple and direct as pulling a finger out of a flame. Spiritual dissonance is a necessary and vital function of the human condition. It's how we operate. It can, like anything, go haywire, but for most of the people, most of the time, it's nothing more than the meeting of two slightly imperfect surfaces, the outermost inner and the innermost outer. A common example of spiritual dissonance would be, if God loves us, why does He allow so much suffering? The certainty of God's love is the internal belief. The obviousness of human suffering is the external reality. Is God unable to end suffering? No, we must answer, because He can do whatever He wants. Therefore, He must allow or even cause suffering. But how can that be if He loves us? Something somewhere has to give, or, preferably, we avoid asking the question in the first place. An ad hoc hypothesis is one way of dealing with messy problems such as this. We come up with a new belief to stuff into the gap between two existing beliefs, like plugging a chink in the wall of our prison cell, where a discomforting light is getting through and disturbing our repose. Such a hypothesis in this situation might be, because God loves us, He gave us free will, and we use it to create our own suffering. This is like a belief patch. We discover a bug in our belief programming,
So we install a belief patch and all is well. The walls that enclose us are made of belief, so a belief patch is likely to blend in well and last as long as the wall does, if we don't tamper with it. Another way we can respond to this problem is to recuse ourselves from such weighty deliberations altogether. The Lord works in mysterious ways, we can say, and be happily done with it. Similarly, we might relieve our discomfort by deferring to specialists. It's the job of the clergy to grapple with such imponderable issues, we might tell ourselves. It's for the shepherds to worry about such things, not the flock. Or we might redouble our emotional investment in God and simply dismiss logical inconsistencies with haughty contempt or mocking disdain. Or we might go the other way and dismiss God altogether, citing conundrums such as this to bolster our case. Or, best and most common, we can go the ignorance is bliss route. We can ignore the question altogether, or deny it, or simply stay occupied and distracted so this question and countless others like it can never gain a foothold in our awareness. Or any number of other scenarios. The main thing is to stop the discomfort, like removing the battery from a blaring smoke detector so we can go back to sleep. Meanwhile, somewhere, a fire burns. Lisa overheard Maggie and me talking about spiritual dissonance and has joined the conversation.